Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. In urban communities, dealing with crime is a major issue and puts all kinds of pressure on local prosecutors. We'll hear from St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce a little later in this program. But first, St. Louis's position as one of the top 10 most segregated cities in the U.S. means in and of itself that it's not unique, nor are the problems that result from our divisions. Our first guest is Jennifer Morales, the author of a book titled Meet Me Halfway, Milwaukee Stories. Milwaukee's on the list, too. It's her city. She's exploring ways to find common ground and is promoting her book by visiting those 10 most segregated cities. She's here for an event tonight, which I'll tell you about just a little bit later. Jennifer, so nice to have you with us. Welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk first about the format of the book, because it's a little bit different. Nine separate stories, but there are some dots that connect them. Just tell me what you were up to there.
Well, it's a little bit character-centric. I was interested in the side characters in each story that I wrote, and then I wondered what would happen if I gave them their own story, and then I tried to work in a wide range of interactions across group lines, whether that was age or gender or race, and see what would happen if I put a character from one story into another story and a new situation.
So what were you up to? What did you want the reader's takeaway to be?
Well, first of all, I wanted to write good stories.
Which you did, by the way. I enjoyed the book very much.
Thank you. But as I was writing them, as I was following this question of what other type of person does this character need to meet to show how Milwaukee is divided? I started to realize that this could be a teaching book. You know, I want it to be a good read very much, but it also can be a teaching book. So I started thinking about what kind of interaction do I need to show to really give a taste of life in a highly segregated city like Milwaukee?
Well, you know, obviously, you could sense as a reader that there was this issue, as is the case in so many cities, including our own, but you didn't beat people over the head with it.
Well, I don't think that beating people over the head is the best way to introduce them to a new concept, although I was a Sunday school teacher for many years, so it has crossed my mind. But I do think that fiction has a special place in helping us look at social problems because people can approach the problem from a slight distance, and so it's less personal. It's less likely to trigger some kind of defensive reaction.
One of the things that struck me was the fact that a lot of the interaction between your characters dealt with relatively minor issues, you know, not the major issues of the day as we're seeing in places like Ferguson and other parts of the country, and I'm sure in Milwaukee too. It was little interactions, a white neighbor getting to know finally a black neighbor that they neither had taken any time in the past to get to know each other. Just a little thing, but it developed into a relationship.
Right. And I think a number of readers have said to me, that's how life is. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems a little haphazard the way relationships form or don't form. And what I was looking at was, how do I lift up these small interactions and show how they can be a little more intentional to choose to bridge those divides and have those conversations over group lines?
Mm-hmm. Tell me something about Milwaukee's situation with regard to race relations.
Well, at the beginning of the book, I quote Governor Wallace from Alabama when he was launching his 1964 presidential campaign. One of his first campaign stops was in the south side of Milwaukee, and he said during that speech, if I ever had to move from Alabama, I would move to the south side of Milwaukee. So that will give you a sense of how much like home the champion of segregation, now segregation forever, felt in our city. So it is what I would call a Rust Belt city. A lot of the industries have moved on, and a lot of the black middle class that was developing as a result of those industries has been lost. Wisconsin has the highest black male incarceration rate in the country, and some of the highest unemployment. And so there's a lot of stress on the African-American community and a lot of longstanding hostility from the white community. There's also a significant Mexican-American population and other Latino community. And the city is so divided that when I first got there in 1991, I used to be able to kind of play this horrible game where I would ask somebody their address on the phone and I would know what color they were with absolute precision. That's how divided it is. So the north side is the African-American neighborhood, the south side is the white neighborhood, and in the middle, just south of downtown, is the Mexican neighborhood.
You know, you can play the same game right here in St. Louis and in many other cities. Obviously, we had a list of the top 10. So that comes as really no surprise. But what did surprise me is I guess I just have not been observant. I had no idea that Milwaukee had this kind of problem.
Yeah, I think the segregation and racism in the North is a surprise to a lot of people because the way the stories came out of, for example, the struggle over slavery in the Civil War is that, you know, South is bad, they have a really bad race problem, and the North is okay. But that certainly has not been the experience of minority groups in the northern Midwest.
You are taking your book tour to two of the 10 cities that I mentioned in the introduction, or the 10 most segregated cities, didn't name them all. What do you hope to accomplish in each of these cities? You're doing this, you certainly decided this is what you wanted to do. What was your motive for it? I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you know, every author who wants to do a tour around their book has to find some way to choose which cities. And because the book does deal with characters crossing over divisions, I thought that organizing it around the 10 most segregated cities would be a good framework. But beyond that basic structure, I'm also really interested, especially in this year post-death of Michael Brown and all the other killings that we've seen, to sort of take the pulse of racial dialogue in these cities that are supposedly the worst in terms of divisions, and see if people will talk to me about race and what kind of questions they have about how to have a conversation over those lines.
What kind of conversations would you hope to have? I mean, there are many different ways you could go in terms of where to go.
Yeah.
What do you hope for?
Well, there's, you know, the question and answer periods after my book events at bookstores, which has been great. People have a lot of interest in figuring out tools for having these conversations. So it's good to hear that sincere inquiry. But I decided that I would do something. I'm a performance artist in addition to a writer, and I like to ask questions in public. Mm-hmm. So I've made a sign that says, please talk with me about race. And my intention is to, at some point during my time in St. Louis here, to sit out in a public park or, you know, a shopping district or something and with my sign and see if people will talk to me about race. And it can be anything. You know, how has race affected your life? Which, you know, maybe, for example, white people don't think race does affect their lives, but it does, or anything else they want to tell me.
Have you had this kind of conversation in Milwaukee?
No, we didn't have time before we left, but I hope to.
Yeah. You have not been able to visit many of the top 10 cities. Chicago, I think, one, and of course St. Louis, another. What about your reception in Chicago?
Well, it was good. It was definitely a multiracial group of readers, and it was interesting to hear how each person related to the book and to different characters. So I think one of the strengths of the book is that because there are so many different characters in it, and most of them are presented very sympathetically, I think a wide range of readers can find some way to connect to the stories.
We certainly don't want to talk about the book in too much detail because you want people to read it. But I don't think, given the way the book is promoted, that it's a spoiler to say that your main character, if I can put it that way, did not survive more than the first couple of pages. He died.
Yes, that's John Quell. He's a African-American teenager headed to UW-Madison for college after high school. And he does a favor for his white neighbor, an older woman named Mrs. Chernicki, and he ends up having an accident and eventually dying. And that starts this chain of events where Mrs. Chernicki then starts reaching out to his family, his younger sisters, and his mom. And then we follow various characters from his family, friends of the family, schoolmates, through their own set of interactions with someone across a group line.
Would it be fair to say, do you think that John Quayle had a chip on his shoulder?
I don't know what you mean.
Well, I'm thinking specifically of the dialogue between him and his teacher with regard to the Vietnam situation. John Quayle had a very specific take on what happened during a riot at a prison in Vietnam. The teacher was there and had a much different take.
Yeah, you know, he was a political kid, and he was very interested in race politics and African American history. And in a subsequent story, I kind of roll back in time. So he's alive and he's attending school. He's finishing out his senior year in high school, and he has he's written a paper about the Vietnam War, and then has a substitute teacher in his high school history class that who was a Vietnam vet. So they have a struggle over both John Quayle's use of language and also about his interpretation of Vietnam. And, yeah, it was interesting. I write the high school paper, the history paper, into the story. And so it was really a fun task for me to try to write like a ideological teenager writing a history paper and his take on American history.
With a couple of common misspellings that I think you might find. You have an education background, so that would not come as a surprise to you.
Yeah, I've seen "they're" spelled many different ways.
Right. My guest is Jennifer Morales. Her book is Meet Me Halfway, Milwaukee Stories. We'll continue our discussion about the book and about some other things as well. If you'd like to get into this conversation, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now, back to our conversation with Jennifer Morales. She will be, by the way, talking about her book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Left Bank Books on Euclid. We'll have more information about that event on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Jennifer, I mentioned earlier that you do have a background in education, and I think that was fairly clear in the book. You reserve some very special thought and writing, I think, for teachers.
Yeah, I love teachers. When I graduated from my undergraduate program, I had an idea that I wanted to teach in an urban public school system. And I went to Milwaukee and took a volunteer job at an organization called Rethinking Schools, which is an education publisher, and read so many stories about how hard it is to be a teacher that I decided I'd rather stay in education publishing and research. So I did that for several years. And eventually, when my children were in the Milwaukee public school system, I ran for school board and served two terms. So I kind of come at education from a number of different perspectives.
It really is an important ingredient, isn't it, with regard to, I don't want to say bringing the races together, but equalizing the playing field.
One would hope. I mean, we see a lot of the same systemic challenges in schools that we do in the broader society. So a lot of the discrimination that happens plays out in the form, for example, of school finance. So a lot of my time on the school board, I was working on trying to get fairer funding systems for schools in Wisconsin. So those resources often don't flow to city schools, and that's a big hurdle for kids to overcome.
I'm guessing that your book was probably pretty close to being finished, if not completed, by the time of the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson last August. Were you finished at that point?
Yeah, it was done.
What was your take on that?
I came to that story mostly as a mom. I have a number of kids, two biological kids who are 19 and 21, so very close in age to Michael Brown. And it just hurts me as a mom, really does. And I see it definitely as a racial situation. You know, I have a story in Meet Me Halfway where two of the African-American students are kind of hassled by a cop about being out of school. And that may seem gentle under the current heightened awareness about police violence against black teens. Mm-hmm. But, you know, definitely there is this sort of day-to-day pattern of hostility that I've observed as a school board member, as a mom, as a neighbor. So
it's really striking how similar the situation is in so many of these cities. I mean, the complaints are the same. The police hassling of young people is the same. There are so many issues that are so strikingly similar. I'm sure you've found that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm already starting to get a little bit of that blur that people get when they're on tour, like, which city am I in? I know I'm in St. Louis right now, of course, but because I hear the same stories from different people.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. We have some folks who want to get into the conversation with Jennifer Morales. So let's start with our first caller, Rosalyn, calling from St. Louis. Rosalyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Thank you for coming to – hello. Thanks for coming to visit St. Louis and share your book with us.
Oh, thank you.
My I guess it's a comment and not a question is, although it's going to start off as a question, what's wrong with having segregated communities? And I just heard you touch on what my answer would have been or my comment would have been to your basics of your book. The basic issue is the inequities that occur in those communities from an override city perspective or community perspective. There's so many different things that those areas lack that the more affluent areas are able to get, not barring the fact that they're more able to provide for those that live in the community, those that are affluent, but just the simple fact of having the basic necessities and having a lack of those or subpar parts of those. To me, that's one of the major reasons that the segregated community seems to be such a terrible part to have. But in my mind, living in a segregated community, everything is somewhat equal all around the various communities. It's not a bad place to be. Thank you.
Thanks. I think I had an Orthodox Jewish woman in Crown Heights, New York, tell me that, you know, she thinks that, people naturally join with people who are like them for mutual support. So in her community, Orthodox Jews need to live close enough together to be able to walk to synagogue on Saturday and have a big enough community to worship together and support each other. And, you know, you see that with immigrants, immigrant communities, you want to have landlords and bankers who speak your language, that sort of thing. But when it's not voluntary, when people don't have the resources to be able to make conscious choices about where they live, I think that's where the problem is. And certainly if it's fueled by hatred or by a sense of superiority of one group over another, that's not a sustainable society. De facto segregation where it just happens because people want to live next to people who have similar needs or a similar culture is one thing. But enforced segregation, even if it's enforced by informal systems like discrimination, feelings, racism, superiority, that's another matter.
You know, a rather exhaustive study was conducted here in St. Louis over the past year and a half or so called For the Sake of All. And one of the most striking results of this survey was that there are certain zip codes in our community in which the life expectancy of the African-American population is 18 fewer years than the life expectancy of someone in a more affluent zip code. That strikes me as one of the things that's really wrong with segregating a community.
Right. And because of the discriminatory feelings that support segregation, you see the direction of resources away. So, you know, if a supermarket chain is looking where to put their next store, they might not choose a neighborhood where they know people are afraid to go. And so, you know, you start seeing this cascade of effects of, well, there's no fresh food in this neighborhood now because there's no supermarket. And then, you know, people can't get fresh fruits and vegetables, so they are less healthy. So, yeah, there is definitely a compounding effect, and it has real consequences for people.
On the other hand, and you've alluded to this both just in your comments recently and in the book, Milwaukee has a voluntary deseg plan, just as St. Louis does. And when the African-American kids go out to an all-white school, they tend to sit together. and not mix as was intended by the plan to kind of mix with the rest of the kids.
Yeah, I think if the numbers are small enough, it's really hard for people to cross over. They need to hold to themselves to have a sense of protection and understanding, mutual understanding. But if you have somebody said it's 20% is a magical number. They told me at my Chicago reading yesterday that if you have 20% of a minority group in a white school, then there's a better mix among the groups. But if it's less than that, the minority group students feel like they have to protect themselves.
Is there any doubt in your mind that when this situation is rectified, whenever that actually is going to be, that it's the young people who are going to make it happen?
I think so. I really do. I think, though, the older generation has to talk about race to the younger generation so that they're well informed. I'm meeting a lot of people on this tour who don't know all sorts of things about American history and how it's been influenced by race and by racism. And so the older generation has to take responsibility for educating.
Let's take another phone call. William joins us from Collinsville. William, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Jennifer Morales.
Hello, Jennifer. Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just have one simple question for you. Jennifer, throughout the course of your research, have you gotten the feel that there's some kind of a underlying power that is causing the racists to segregate? Or do you feel as though there's something behind the scene that... And I'm not just talking about comfort zone for people, because I'm looking at areas whereby people are living in poverty for years. But at the same time, you have white people living in poverty and black people living in poverty, and both of them are impoverished, but yet voting differently. Can you speak on that for me, please?
I will try. I am a fiction writer, not a researcher anymore. But, I do think that the issue of poverty is important, that racism and racist structures are supported by economic insecurity. And so we saw that from the very beginning of America's history, where indentured white servants brought over from Europe were given a sense of superiority over the black indentured servants, and told, you can work your way out of this servitude contract, but the black people were discouraged from doing so and really seeing themselves as economically inferior and dependent on their employer. So, it's old stuff, and I think over the years economic insecurity has been used to support racist structures and vice versa.
Thank you for the call. I'll take another call now as time begins to wind down for us, but Scott, plenty of time for you. Scott in Chesterfield, it's your turn.
Yeah. According to a HUD study, Housing and Urban Development, there may be subtle discrimination against Asian Americans or Asians. For example, they're shown 7% fewer rental units, and like 15% fewer housing units. And HUD says this is probably a subtle form of discrimination. And I'm wondering, if there is discrimination against Asians, why would that be? What would the rationale or justification for that be?
I wish I could tell you why people discriminate against different groups. I think we have a natural tendency to be wary of people who are different from us. But in my work, I'm hoping to give some examples, even if they're fictional, of ways that people make the connection and say, I'm not that different, actually. I thought I was. I've been programmed to think I am. But I'm not. We're the same.
Your surname is Morales.
Yes.
Have you run into this? Hispanics, people of that heritage have also... suffered problems along these lines.
Yes. Just yesterday, my sister was reminding me that when we moved out of Chicago into a suburb that our family was called Spix, which is, very harsh term for Latinos, and, you know, we weren't allowed to play with the other kids in the neighborhood and not invited over to the houses. And so, yeah, it does happen.
Has that changed, do you think, since the days you were talking about when you were younger?
It depends on the situation. I mean, look at what happened when the Central American children, you know, unaccompanied minors were coming as immigrants, you know, and people were saying, oh, they've got diseases and they're, you know, going to lower our test scores in our public schools and all these things. I mean, it's the same rhetoric. Mm. So
it's going to be interesting to see how your conversations evolve as you continue this book tour. Where do you go next after St. Louis?
We are headed to Columbus and Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Buffalo, Detroit, and then back to Milwaukee.
Wow. Well, that's quite an extensive tour. I've known people who have taken such tours, and the biggest problem they tell me they have is remembering their room number, whatever hotel they happen to be visiting. Jennifer Morales, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Best of luck to you with the book. The book is Meet Me Halfway, Milwaukee Stories. Jennifer will be talking about that book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Left Bank Books on Euclid. Coming up, Jennifer Joyce. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.